All right, we're back. This is Jay Flemma Sports Report. I am Jay Flemma, and we are on the Golf News Net and iHeartRadio. So a big thank you to our first guest on the show, Ian Jamson of Formby. That was a lot of fun talking about Morris Flitcroft and Horace the Hippo and that zany owl and the contributions of Bruce Ismay, but also that wonderful golf course. But we're going to switch gears now and take it up even further a notch. Many of you have seen some of the articles that I've written about Royal Lytham and St. Ann's. I got a chance to spend two magnificent days at that absolutely majestic golf course. Without doubt, the Westminster Abbey of golf, they crown immortals there. And the experience is, well, princely and indeed regal. Okay, everybody who loves golf's got to go there. And now for our second guest, we have their unofficial historian and former captain of the links and author of one of their history books, The Royal and Lytham St. Ann's Golf Club and the Amateur Game, which we will definitely get into. Please welcome Dr. Stephen Reed. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to join us. Tell us all about the marvels of Lytham from the beginning, please.
Well, its earliest days were quite difficult for it to manage because they built a golf course and then within 4 years were told that they couldn't have the land any longer and they'd have to go. That wasn't the happiest start. And then they had to decide to build a new course near at hand.
Now, where was the old course located?
Well, St. Ann's was a town that was only just starting at that time. The first few stones had only been laid in 1874, so the town hardly existed. And like so many golf courses, the golf course was built near a railway line. To get onto the course, you got off the train, walked through a gate, and you were on the first tee. And it was on the inland side of the railway line. It was probably quite a good course, but it was opened 1 week after the club was formed, so the poor old greenkeepers didn't have much chance to do much work on it.
So tell us a little bit about how they chose the links land on which the course now stands, and tell us about the gentleman that started to build the holes and design the course.
Well, the course for the land for the second course, when they realized they'd have to do something, three or four gentlemen went down to the next railway station down the line, and they did what they call the Great Walk. They walked from there back towards St. Ann's, and they identified land on the inland side of the railway. And that became the course that we play on today.
Do we know who those gentlemen were?
What was interesting is the person who should have been there wasn't. Talbot Fair was there, Marcus Ray, and somebody else whose name escapes me. But the person who should have been there was Alexander Dolman, who was the man, the Scot from Musselburgh, who had actually brought golf to the area. I don't know why he was missed out.
Okay, and so what happened then? Tell us about the hiring of golf course architects and the planning out of the individual holes.
Well, golf course architects hardly existed then. Down at Hoylake, Jack Morris was the professional there, and he had an assistant called Lowe, George Lowe. And
Sure.
George Lowe had taken up his job as the professional at St. Ann's, at Lytham and St. Ann's, and he designed the course. It was only his second attempt. You'll have heard of Hesketh Golf Course near Southport. He designed that the year before. So he set off with all this land in front of him, but he had one marvelous advantage. He could take as long as he wanted before the members would say, right, let us on the course. And it took 3 years.
And so is there's a bit of a story. Didn't it sort of go that he sort of sent word over to the members, come and have sort of a soft opening unofficial tournament, let me know what you think, and then the members liked it so much they said, yeah, we're coming over immediately. Is that sort of how it went?
Yeah, they did play one competition when he wasn't quite ready for it to be opened. But they came and played on it, enjoyed themselves, and then they went back for one last affectionate, nostalgic round on the old course before finally moving. The ladies had a bit of a difficult, different deal. They were suddenly told 1 week, you're off, disappear now. The ladies had a less dignified transfer than the men had.
What did the ladies do?
When the first course was built, the old course, there was a separate course built for the ladies. This was very much ahead of its time to have a ladies' course, same as Formby has to this day. And the ladies' course was good. But what the men did in 1893 at the old course, before they moved to the new one, is they had the ladies' amateur championship for the whole of the British Isles. That was held at St. Anne's.
Oh, terrific. Who won that tournament?
Lady Margaret Scott.
Oh, the famous lady, of course. Tell us about Lady Margaret Scott.
Well, she was the, in some ways, she was the Bobby Jones or the Ben Hogan of her time, because she turned up, she won the first championship, just sailed through every round, beat a very good opponent in the final by a big margin. Then the next year she went to Littlestone in Kent and she won there. And then the third year she went to Port Rush in Northern Ireland and she won there. Then she hung up her clubs. She had achieved all there was to achieve and effectively never played again.
Like the Moroccan belt was given to young Tom Morris after three victories, did she get to keep whatever trophy it was after her three victories?
No, they didn't know she was disappearing. I think
Ah.
Don Morris got the belt because that was one of the conditions. If anyone wins it three times, he keeps it.
Right. I thought perhaps maybe they might have had something similar for the ladies.
I think they learned their lesson.
I do. Well, I do know that there's some wonderful trophies at Lytham too. We'll get into them. So let's talk a little bit more about the design of the golf course. How has it evolved over time since George Lowe's layout?
Well, there's two things happened. Firstly, George Lowe's layout was very good. It was a well-designed course. He had time to get it right, and it was very well suited for the clubs and balls of its time.
In fact, what George Lowe holes or what George Lowe features still exist to this day so that we can identify them on the course, especially the next time I come. I'll want to see those.
Pretty well the same as they were with the other first and second holes. Then the seventh has only changed in recent years. Going on the there's a few holes around the change around the end that were changed by Harry Colt.
Yes, like
Pretty
eight
similar.
especially.
16, 17, and 18 are pretty well unchanged, apart from the 17th, the green was moved. So there's about a third of the holes feel as though they were what George Lowe laid out, and then 12 are what Harry Colt brought in the 1920s.
They do fit with George Lowe's architectural style, too. He was always a little bit more penal than some of his peers were.
Yeah, and the course he laid out at the time it was laid out was the longest in the kingdom.
Yes,
It was
he
long
was a
and
very good.
difficult.
Who was the gentleman that he used to get in arguments with in that magazine all the time? That they would go back and forth where he would say something, and then was it Mackenzie who would argue with him, or was it, I'm drawing a blank right now. You know, those old-timey magazines from back in the day where they would write articles. The American Golfer, that magazine.
Well,
Well, anyway.
C.B. MacDonald was a pretty lively contributor to that.
And someone called themselves Far and Sure as a writer, too. That was their nom de plume. They published.
In America or here?
Yes, in America, they published under the nom de plume Far and Sure, which also happens to be the slogan of Royal Liverpool, but they
I'm
kept their
very good at
identity a secret to most. But
that.
so let's continue a little bit more. Tell us about Harry Colt's work, and then tell us about the work that's being done now by Martin Eber.
The course was obviously becoming outdated with the change in ball and equipment, but then the First World War put everything on a hold. Colt came in 1919 and introduced a good raft of changes because the club was hoping to get allocated the Open Championship. Then in 1923, along came the North British Championship, and it was won by a diminutive golfer called Gene Sarazen. And Gene Sarazen finished first, and Walter Hagen finished second. So the first thing the
Those two
Colt
men
has
won
done is
seven claret jugs.
identified the best players. But the RNA came back and said the course wasn't difficult enough. So Harry Colt came back and made a few more changes. There was another professional tournament the following year, which Abe Mitchell won, and he took about 15 more shots than Gene Sarazen had done. So they recognized the course was difficult enough then for the Open. And Harry Colt had done a lot of very good changes. He'd moved the third green about 50 yards on. He'd taken the fifth green, which was in a hollow, and replaced it with a green built up where you fell off every side, a very much a Colt feature.
Yep.
The sixth green, he'd moved, taken a punch bowl green and moved it onto the side. Two holes at the end, he just completely changed to create the
eight and nine, sure.
When the green's up on a height. And that night, you remember the nice little dinky hole down into the corner?
I wouldn't call it dinky. I think it's charming. I find it as prim as a cameo. That gorgeous little par three on the end there. Okay, surrounded by the village.
Yes, okay. It's an evil little hole, though. I mean, Bobby Jones only had 1-3 in his four rounds.
No, the two, my nemesis thus far, number eight, ate me alive both rounds.
Yeah.
And there, I took four to get out of a bunker on the fifth hole. So I had
I did mark a card for somebody once playing the ninth hole. He was eager not to have a no return. He wanted to complete his score. And he did eventually finish the hole with the 31 strokes for the one hole.
Who was this?
Very much an amateur. A pal of mine, he was left-handed, but he was he just had a bad day that day.
He must have been trying to hit the ball with his nose. Okay, 31 shots.
he was excavating sand for quite a long time.
Did he get black lung disease? We actually, at my beloved home course, Forsgate, the bunker greenside at number 8, 30 feet deep, is black lung bunker because it is that deep. So let's talk a little bit more about what are Colt features and how would we identify those on the golf course? Besides the runoffs on the greens at, say, number 5 and number 9.
Yeah, I think the word that applies to Colt is cunning.
Yes.
The word cunning is derived from a Dutch word of to know, kennen. And it doesn't mean stealth or wickedness. I think cunning just means you can get in somebody's mind and know how their mind works.
Yes. Shrewdness.
Yeah. And cunning, the cunningness, obviously, the biggest feature of rhythm is its bunkering. And it isn't the number of bunkers, it's where they are and how they gather. You know,
yes.
They gather the top player, they gather the average player, they gather the not so good player. Just the whole course is dominated by the bunkering. You can get round and avoid them. You can, but you don't often.
It is the imperative. Okay, I shot seven strokes better when I found three fewer bunkers in the two rounds that I played. And that is the most important thing. Let's talk a little bit about the changes that Martin Ebert has made.
Well, the changes have come in two phases. Firstly, he did some changes a few years ago to holes like the seventh hole. In the last year or two, there's some changes being consequent on changing the practice area. You'll remember the 11th
That's
hole
correct, yes.
And the big new practice area. So because of that, he had to redesign the 7th and 11th hole.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do an awful lot to the rest of the course, mainly because it didn't need an awful lot doing to it. He did a big bunker revision where he took about 40 bunkers out, bunkers that weren't relevant. And sadly, there's an economic cost to running a bunker. You know, it's year on year on year.
Especially with that one. Yes, every 3 or 4 years you have to redo them because people are smashing balls into the face all the time.
Yeah, revetting is only a fairly recent feature of bunkers at Lytham.
Yes, that's right. I've been watching some of the old videos. You didn't have them like that in 74 or even in 79 when Seve was swashbuckling his way to his first of back-to-back victories at Lytham.
That's right. Well, if you look at, I forget the exact figures, but if in Tony Jacklin, he was in 15 bunkers, 13 times he got up and down in two shots. And Seve was in 16 bunkers in 1979 and he got up and down in 14 out of 16. The bunkers weren't intimidating then. They were playable. Peter Thompson thought the bunkers were easier than the rough. We talked about another time, we talked about him deliberately aiming at a bunker rather than aiming to hit a glassy downwind green at the ninth.
Yes, at the par 3 ninth. Yes, similar to what Billy Casper did at Wingfoot in the 1959 US Open. Rather than risk the bunkers at their beautiful par 3 10th hole, he simply played short all 4 days, chipped on, and made three the hard way, and won the tournament. He walked off with a, well, it's not a claret jug for the US Open. It's a loving cup. It's a rather beautiful one, too, just as gorgeously encrusted as yours is. So, well, while we're on the topic of the great open championships at Lytham, we have to start with the 1926 Open and Bobby Jones winning as an amateur, and that remarkable mashie niblick out of a bunker from blind behind a hill to a green. And he put it even closer than his opponent, Al Watrous, a shot heard round the world, and what John Hopkins called one of the three greatest golf shots in history.
It was a mashie niblick wouldn't have got the distance he needed. It was a mashie, which is about a 4.5 iron in modern clubs.
Thank you.
It was
Thank you. Mash.
175 yards is a fair distance to get to a bunker, a green you can't even see.
Yes, it is. It was
It
a
was
heck of
all
a
or
screw.
nothing. And it must have been in a terrible mental state at that point. This was his second trip to this side of the Atlantic. The first trip was a failure in the amateur and a failure at the Open. He'd failed at the amateur, losing to Andrew Jemison. And if he hadn't exceeded that shot, he'd have failed again. And you wonder how he would have got on. He certainly wouldn't have gone back to America and won the US Open 3 weeks later. He certainly wouldn't have gone on to win everything. I think mentally that transformed his whole life, that one shot.
It does echo through the century of history here at Lytham. Tell us a few more of your favorite bellwether moments, and I'll trade you a few of mine.
Bellwether is a new expression to me.
Well, in terms of those historical moments that ring, forever. For example, okay, as much as it's a horror story to me, we'll all never forget Adam Scott falling out of the sky like Icarus, and Ernie Els picking up a claret jug he found on the ground. Yes, it's a cautionary tale and a sad story, but again, it was unforgettable drama and theater.
It was sad to watch Adam Scott because he didn't do anything wrong. He got a birdie at the 14th. He was about three shots ahead. And at the 15th, he just pulled the shot slightly and it just ran off into the left-hand bunker of the green. The 17th, he only pulled it slightly and it ran off to the left of the green. The only bad shot he hit was his short putt on the 16th. But then on the 18th tee, he took a 2 iron the first 3 days. And for some reason, best known to him, and he's never had a good chat about it with anyone I know, he took a 3 wood from the tee and put it straight into the second row of bunkers.
And had to play out sideways.
Yeah, once you're in those, you're dead. Those bunkers were only added in for the 1958 Open. They weren't put in by Harry Colt. Harry Colt liked his diagonal bunkers, like the first set
Yes,
of
like
bunkers
on
is diagonal.
18.
And somebody else added those second row of three diagonal bunkers. But they played a big
Ah.
part. In the first Open that they were played, three players came to the last tee only needing a four to get into the playoff with Peter Thomson. And all three of them drove into that last of the three bunkers, Eric Brown, Christy O'Connor Sr., and Leopold Ruiz. And they all failed to get a four. They got two fives and a six. So that bunker was expensive. As
What
to
can you
where the
tell
bye
us?
shots go, I think Tony Jacklin's drive at the last hole was lovely. He'd staggered his way around as best he could. He was holding his game together, and Henry Longhurst was commentating from behind the tee, and he stitched this beautiful drive with the old persimmon-headed driver.
Oh, yes, the famous line.
Henry Longhurst's lovely line. Oh my goodness, what a corker!
What a corker. Yes. What can you tell us about the playoff between Bob Charles and Doug Sanders?
Bob Charles, Bob Charles was a beautifully calm, calculating golfer. The person he was up against in the playoff was a had a more emotional approach, Phil Rogers.
Yes, the demonstrative ex-Marine.
Yeah, and Phil Rogers was a little bit naughty when it came to the 72nd hole before the playoff.
Yes.
Rogers held his short putt and rather dramatically took his hat off, his cap off, and dropped it over the hole. And Rogers, Bob Charles still had a four-footer to make. And Rogers said afterwards he didn't know where he was. He'd lost his thinking. And I think he was genuine when he said he didn't do it deliberately.
Well, yes, because he was one of the few golfers that played with his heart on his sleeve.
Yeah.
Okay, he nowadays you never see that. They don't play with that emotion, except perhaps in the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
Okay, but Rogers, you know, he was dropping the putter and waving his hands and kissing to the crowd and blowing this kisses in here and there, except on one occasion. Wait, have I? Yes, that's right. Okay. And I just realized I have to make a correction in my article because it wasn't Phil Rogers that lost that playoff to Jack Nicklaus in 1970. It was Doug Sanders.
Doug Sanders?
Yes.
Doug Sanders was at St Andrews with Jack
That's
Nicklaus.
Right. That's
and that's
right.
where Nicklaus threw his putter up in the air.
And poor Doug Sanders had a duck. Yes. So, but Phil Rogers was the one that lost the playoff to Bob Charles.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Phil Rogers, they were an interesting pair because Bob Charles golfed left-handed, but he was a right-handed person. He used a pen in his right hand.
And it's usually the other way around.
Yeah, and Phil Rogers was a right-handed golfer, but he signed papers with his left hand.
We're talking with Stephen Reed, author of The Royal Rhythm and St. Anne's Golf Club and the Amateur Game. Before we go to break, give us one more great story of your favorite Open Championships at Lytham.
I think it'd have to be Bobby Locke. It's one of the people I wish I'd seen play Bobby Locke because he was just a one-off on his own. And you know, the railway line comes down the right hand of the first, second, third, seventh, and eighth. Bobby Locke hit the ball out over the trees, over the railway line, and then waited. And about 6 seconds later, the ball came back in off the railway line and reappeared in the middle of the fairway. And he did that all the time. But he was accused by his fellow professionals of being very slow. They were indignant that he'd taken over 3 hours to play a round of golf. And Norman von Nieder, the Australian, put in an official complaint. Bobby Locke walked very slowly. When he got to the ball, he hit it quite quickly. But he walked up the fairway with great poise and style. And somebody said he walked down the fairway like a bishop going to the pulpit to give a sermon about adultery.
I'm Jay Flemma. You're listening to Jay Flemma Sports Report on Golf Newsnet and iHeartRadio. We will be right back after this. That was an excellent segment. Way to end it, too. That was beautiful. I want to take a fast look at my notes. That was perfect, too. In fact, we did that beautifully. Let me see now. Where were we? Pick up where we left off. Here we go. Okay, so.
I'll be coming back on shortly.
Yes, we're going to. I'm just looking at the amateur game mile marks here. So the first big amateur tournament, 1897. The first pro tournament was 1890, 1893. The first Bernardes Amateur Championship, Lady Margaret Scott. Bobby in 1926. And then another amateur in 55, 86, 07. The Curtis Cup in 61, 22. And then some of the famous names like Michael Balinok, is that right? How to pronounce that?
Banalik.
Banalik.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the Silver Shrimp. Who gets the Silver Shrimp?
It's a game played, the club gave it to the Oxford and Cambridge Golfing Society. Oxford and Cambridge have a golf society which comes over to America, plays at Merion and Pine Valley. And it comes up here from time to time. And it's actually here tomorrow, the Oxford and Cambridge Golfing Society.
Do they get to take the shrimp home with them if they win it?
It's an interesting one that it technically belongs to them. Our club gave it to them, but they left it here for about 50 years. And then in 2001, they did take it away and they keep it at Rye,
No,
Rye
the shrimp.
in Kent.
I just saw the shrimp in the trophy case. I got a picture of it.
And that's a duplicate
Oh,
or a
okay.
facsimile, I don't know what you'd call it. The original one is it's a source of some dismay because we'd like to have it up here, and it's on display here, but it's when it's down in Rye, it's locked away in a cupboard. Nobody can see it.
Well, why don't you play them for
Yeah,
it? Seriously, play them for it.
possession is nine tenths of the law, they think.
All right, there you. Well, that's the whole point. Say, hey guys, come on, we want to play for it. All right, so I'll call us back into the second segment. Countdown from seven, last 2 years silent, and then and we'll go. Seven, six, five, four. All right, we're back, everybody. I'm Jay Flemmett. We're here with Stephen Reed, the unofficial historian and the 1996 captain of the Lynx at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, the Westminster Abbey of golf, one of its most holy grounds, place where 11 open championships were contested. 10 different winners because Severiano Ballesteros won there twice. We neglected to touch on Seve in the first segment. Why don't you tell us a couple of quick, how about some of your favorite Seve stories?
Oh, the nice thing with Seve when he first opened, he took the advice of Roberto De Vincenzo, the wonderful Argentinian golfer. What he was told by Roberto was play from your heart. Don't be cold and calculating. And he played what we were talking about a little while ago, the emotional golf. He just threw himself at the ball with almost a happy abandon. He kept on finding his ball and he kept on hitting it again. And he cleaned up. He hit that extraordinary shot on the 16th hole where he blazed it about 60 yards right into a car park. It was good they found the ball underneath the car,
That's right. And he had to
but
take a
find the owner
drop.
of the car. The owner of the car wasn't available. So he got a drop from there. And being Seve, instead of just putting it somewhere on the green, he stitched it close, holed a putt for the most ridiculous birdie three, and broke Hale Irwin's heart. Hale Irwin came down the last fairway waving a white handkerchief of surrender.
Wasn't that more though because he had to fight his way through the mob? You'll
I have
also
money on
remember.
Hale Irwin. I'd reckoned in the beginning of the week Hale Irwin was going to win, and I was
And
heartbroken watching him not win.
now there are a number of stories about that handkerchief that I can tell you from America, though. Only 3 weeks before, at the 1979 US Open that Hale Irwin had won, okay, some of the other golfers were waving the white towels at him as he was coming down the fairway.
All right.
Earlier in the season, Dr. Gil Morgan had holed out a double eagle on a par five on a Saturday, and that's what triggered the whole thing. He had something like a 5-shot lead, and he was the last guy on the course on Saturday. And when he holed out for a two, it was an 8-shot lead, and like four guys come out and they grab their golf towels. And they did the full mock surrender. They came out there like, all right, enough, we give up, we give up. Okay. And the next day was a coronation. So that's where that comes from. There's actually a rich history back in the 70s of guys doing that. Okay. It also happened at the US Open in at was it where it happened at Wingfoot. Where was the Wingfoot Open? 84. Okay, when he returned to Wingfoot in 84, Zeller gave Greg Norman the white flag on Saturday and then ended up beating him in a playoff. Actually,
Oh, no.
it wasn't on Saturday, it was on Sunday. Yes, I remember now what happened was Zeller had been signing his scorecard and didn't see that Norman had a chip out of the woods. And so when Norman holed the shot, he thought it was for eagle, not birdie, or something.
Oh,
That's how it went. But then he filleted him in the playoff the next day.
that's the nice thing with Seve's second win, it was completely the opposite. He then was he had some idea where the ball was going, and his last round was so measured. He played the first five holes in level par. The next six holes he played in five under par, and then he parred his way in. And on the 16th hole, which he'd done in a cavalier style in 79, he hit a 4 iron down the middle of the fairway, 9 iron to 2 inches from the hole, and that broke Nick Price. That was the end of Nick Price's attempt to hang on to his coattails.
Yes, that was the clinching shot in the clutch. That was the thing about Seve. Okay, very rarely would you ever see him spit the bit in the clutch. The only example I could think of is 13 at Augusta National. Sorry, 15 at Augusta National when Jack Nicklaus passed him to win. So let's talk about some of the great amateur championships that have been held at Lytham. It has a rich history in that as well, starting with the very first ladies tournament that Lady Margaret Scott won in 1893. You were telling me an interesting story that wasn't it her father, Lord Eldon, that had to give the acceptance speech?
Yeah, she was allowed to have the trophy put into her hands, but it wasn't considered fitting for a lady to address a crowd. So she then went demurely back to her seat and sat down, and her father, Lord Eldon, gave the gracious speech on her behalf, thanking the people who had organized the trophy for her, the competition.
And then the first amateur championship was won by the great Lawson Little in 1935.
Yeah, Lawson Little was a in his own time was just as good a player as some of the top players, amateur or professional. The previous year, he'd won at Prestwick by an obscene margin of 14 holes up and 13 to play. And he played at Lytham. It was the first amateur, as you say, and he got to the final, winning each round pretty easily. But he came up against Bill Tweddle, a very unassuming family physician, you'd call him, who worked flat out near Birmingham. And Bill Tweddle was a good golfer. He'd won the amateur in 27 at Hoylake, and he was captain of the GB&I team in 1928 at Chicago when Bobby Jones was the captain of the American team. And Bill Tweddle really hung on to Lawson Little all the way, and finally just lost by one hole at the 36th hole of a 36-hole final.
Oh, that had to be a heck of a tournament, too. Plus, what a great honor for Tweddle to captain the GB&I team. And that 1928 cup was at Chicago Golf Club, the phenomenal McDonald golf course.
And there was a nice thing, the friendship that golf generates. The two men were co-captains. When Jones won at Hoylake, he was completely destroyed, I mean, exhausted when he finished. You know, Darwin saw him in the secretary's office, hardly able to hold a glass of liquor with two hands. The next day, Jones turned up at Tweddle's course over in Blackwell near Birmingham because he said he would. And he played an exhibition match. And that was a great example of the store that Jones put by friendship.
And Jones also kept up correspondence with all of the clubs as well, which was a wonderful gesture, too.
We had I was just looking at some letters. It was a bit of a sad letter. Jones was back in the country in 1958 when he captained the Eisenhower team, but he was in his wheel, not quite in his wheelchair. He was barely able to walk. And there's a letter where we invited him to, if you're in the British Isles, do come in and see us. And he wrote a lovely letter back saying, "I don't think my mobility will let me do that. I'm just coming straight to St Andrews, back to Prestwick Airport and flying home." And when you saw Jones, when he accepted the freedom of St Andrews, trying to move from a seated position just a few steps, you realize how impaired his mobility was. It's heartbreaking to watch.
And you have a great many of those letters framed in those gorgeous trophy cases at the club.
Yeah, they're nice to have. I mean, Jones was a great letter writer. In his later years, somebody came to Lytham and tried to play the shot Jones had played and said, "How on earth did he try that?" And it was the BBC were recording a match. And the BBC fella said to this golfer from near Manchester, "Write to Jones and ask him." And he wrote to Jones and said, "How did you play that shot?" And he got a lovely letter back 3 weeks later. And Jones used the story from the Brer Rabbit stories. If you remember Brer Rabbit, which we read
Yes.
as kids. They were lovely stories. They all had moral tales in them. And little Brer Rabbit always managed to trick Brer Fox. But one time, Brer Rabbit ran away and ran up a tree. And the little child listening to the story said to Uncle Remus, "Rabbits can't climb trees." And Uncle Remus said, "They can climb trees when they're obliged to." And what he meant by obliged was obliged to. In other words, when they've got to climb the tree. They have
Yeah.
no choice. And
There's the
John
answer.
joked
How he
back.
hit the shot, he was obliged to.
Yeah, he said, I guess I was obliged to play that sharp."
Forgive my horrible American pronunciation of that word. That's a great quote. And so then in 1935, another great player, Joe Conrad, won.
1955, yeah, John
Sorry,
Joe Conrad
55.
was
Apologies.
he was on the American Walker Cup team, but he was considered one of the less outstanding players. But the other players got lost out in the early rounds, and Conrad got to the final and played brilliantly in horrible weather, and he saw off an English player in the final there, and he was a very accomplished player, Joe Conrad.
The weather is the great equalizer, without question, especially in links. While we're on that topic, talk to us a little bit about the wind at Lytham.
The first thing about the wind at Lytham is it never helps. In other words, if it's in the prevailing direction, it's downwind on the way out, and it doesn't help because your pitches to the green, just instead of stopping, just run on and slide past the hole to the back edge of the green. And it doesn't help you on the way back because it's into you then, and it takes your short game and messes your big game up as well. It can switch as well. I did have one time I stood on the ninth tee, the little short hole at the end. And
Yes.
it was into the wind, and I was knocking a shot into the wind. And then 5 minutes later, I was on the 10th tee playing back in the opposite direction, and it had turned right round and it was into me again. And the tide turns, the wind can change at the same time.
Sure. You have to watch for that as well. But most importantly, on those last six holes where they go from the north-south access, sorry, access to a diagonal access, or
Yeah.
at times they dogleg in a strange place.
Yeah.
And so you're changing wind direction on every shot almost.
Yeah, the last five, six holes, apart from the 18th, almost zigzag. So you're never comfortable. It's an unsettling course. It's unsettling even without the wind because of the bunkering. It's unsettling with the wind. It's a brutal trial of your game, physical and mental.
I will never allow it to be that frightening to me because A, I love it so much, and B, I have embraced its quirks and its idiosyncrasies, its
Yeah.
strange routing, its murderous bunkers, its challenge, its wind. If you embrace all of that, okay, you can fall in love with it very easily. There's so much charm, and rhythm is singular in the golf world for all of those reasons. Okay, all the par fives and par threes are done by the 12th hole, and you've got six par fours to finish, the last five of which are a real gauntlet. And so when you add in the wind and the weather, you can sometimes see how that can be a great equalizer. We almost saw Tom Watson win a Claret Jug in 2009 in 4 days of, wait for it, crosswinds.
Yeah.
That was what befuddled everybody. He was the only one that could slingshot that drive into the fairway consistently. He loved playing in the wind, the worse the better. So that's where a chance a little guy like me can actually hang tight with everybody, because we're not going to get blown away. We're going to keep it nice and head high and low and hit stingers all day. So,
Leonard Crawley, who was a good player, he described them as one of the fiercest, noblest, and fairest of all the great courses. It's fair.
absolutely true. Absolutely true. And then was it another 31 years before the amateur returned and David Curry won?
Yeah, that was in '86, and the reason that the RNA allocated the amateur then, the amateur had fallen into a bit of a quiet phase. It used to be that the amateur was as important as the open, same as in America, the US amateur and the US Open were equally important to each other. The amateur had fallen aside a bit, and it was tending to be allocated to quieter courses, if you like, courses that weren't hosting the Open but were still good courses. They brought it back to Lytham in 86 because we were celebrating our centenary, and that was a nice way to mark it. And David Currie was a good player who performed well, but he ran up. He in the final he was against a very good player, but a player who was a kind of old-fashioned amateur, whereas David Currie was the modern amateur playing all the time, and it was a bit of a one-sided final. Still good though.
Now, I actually skipped an important milestone. There was also a Ladies Curtis Cup in 1961.
Yeah, Curtis Cup was it's a lovely event because it's the in those days there weren't in significant terms there weren't any women professionals on this side, and the professional tour was only just getting going really on the other on your side with was it Patty Berg and people like that, Louise Suggs.
Sure.
But it was effectively the Curtis Cup with the top women players.
They're two of our immortals, by the way.
Oh yeah, I've heard a lot about them. And I met Louise Suggs. She won the women's amateur here in 1948, and she came over in 86, and we made a nice fuss of her because she was quite something.
By any chance, might you have met, or might the club have had Pat Harbottle?
Not to my knowledge, no. But the Curtis Cup was the best players in the British Isles and America. America won quite effectively, but it was still lovely to see the skills that the girls had. Nowadays, the women have the advantage of graphite shafts. They were playing in those days with steel shafts, which are much less forgiving. But I don't know if you remember the 14th hole,
Oh, yes, of
the long
course.
four. And there's some bunkers about 80 yards just short of the green on the left edge of the fairway. They eat it about 80 yards short of the green. One of the Americans players drove a ball just past those bunkers. Now that's about
That's a heck of a drive. That's large.
355, 360.
Happily, Stephen, every inch of your club is unforgettable. So hopefully, I don't hit golf balls into them. There might be a few bunkers. As always happens, so the minute you think you know a golf course, you hit a shot into a bunker you didn't even know was there, and it cost you a triple.
Yeah, it happens.
Now, also in the 60s, I believe it was 1965, saw the beginning of one of Lytham's great events, the Lytham Cup.
Yeah, this was an idea of Colin McLean, who's our senior past captain. He was captain in 1974, and he's in his early 90s now, but he's still bright as a button. And he worked out that there was no 72-hole stroke play competition for the top amateurs. The Open was there for the professionals, and there was no four-round competition for the top amateurs. And he introduced it with Gerald Micklem, who was the leading figure of English amateur golf. And they got the first weekend in May as the weekend to play it. That was a dangerous decision, in as much as it could be snow, it could be hailstones, it could be a howling gale, or it could be nice. But the reason it works, it's the beginning of the year. In the same way as the Masters is the beginning of the year for the Pro Tour in America, for the amateurs, the Lytham Trophy is the sign that the year is really starting. And
Nice, wonderful.
nowadays is with the world amateur rankings, there's players from all over Europe and the States come over to have a go at the Lytham Trophy. It's a great one to win.
Tell us about some of the famous players that have won the Lytham Trophy.
There's a few people have had wins at it. A few people haven't quite had wins at it. Could perhaps mention them first. Paul McGinley, who was the Walker Cup captain, the Ryder Cup captain. He finished third twice. A young player we'd never heard of since, called Rory McIlroy, finished third twice, and Porrick Harrington finished third twice, as did Shane Lowry. So finishing third twice was a good thing to do in the Lytham Trophy. As regards winners, perhaps it was nice to see Michael Bunalek winning. He won the amateur itself many times, five or six times, and
And
he.
didn't he win something like five within a 10-year period?
Yeah, he was just he was quite something. His swing was nothing to look at from the purist point of view, but he had a incredible short game, and his he holed putts from everywhere. He went round Ganton in 61 shots in those days, was unbelievable in an amateur final. He was quite something, and it was nice to see him winning it.
Now, also, just like Seve won back-to-back Open Championships at Leuven, so too did Sherry Steinhauer win back-to-back Ladies Open Championships at Leuven.
She did. She was a pretty committed contestant. She knew what she was doing, and she set about doing it. She was quite something. And then we've had Annika Sorestens won that event as well, and Catriona Matthews, and Georgia Hall. There's been some good winners, and we're looking forward to having that event again here in 2026.
Every time I see my friend John Huggin, the great Scottish writer, he's always celebrating two people the most, Catriona Matthews and Michael Campbell.
Yeah, one of our members went up to play in North Berwick, and he had a little girl caddying for him, a 14-year-old girl, and he was patronizingly patting her on the top of the head and saying, "Do you play golf, little girl?" And she said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Have you got a handicap yet?" And she says, "Yes, I have." "And what handicap is it?" "+4." Yeah,
And
that
who was that young lady? Was that Catriona Matthew?
was young Catriona Matthews.
I kind of had a similar story. I was at the opening of Bayonne Golf Club one day when a very pretty little blonde girl came bouncing by, and I'm having a really cheerful conversation with her, and one of my friends comes by and goes, "Oh, so you've met so you've met Paula Creamer." I'm like, "Wait, you're Paula Creamer?" She's like, "Yeah." I'm like, and I saved it. I said, "Oh, you're much prettier in person." So I'll tell you what else is pretty. Of all the gorgeous trophies, of course, number one is the claret jug, but I was partial to that cool-looking silver shrimp that you guys have in the trophy case. Okay, that's got to be one of the coolest trophies I've ever seen anywhere, and definitely singular in its appearance. Very living in that regard. Tell us about that silver shrimp.
Well, the shrimp is the emblem of Lytham. You might have seen on the jumpers the shrimp. There used to
Oh, I
be a
have.
thing, shrimping used to be a great thing, catching shrimps just off the beach just near us. There's very few shrimps left now, but there's still two men still make a living out of it. The shrimp, when the Oxford and Cambridge Golf Society kept on coming back to players, we decided in the 1920s to we gave them the silver shrimp. It's made of solid silver. And we presented it to them. And the shrimp has the two antennae like a lobster would have. If you've played in the match between Oxford and Cambridge, you're allowed to light your cigar from one of the antennae. You take the antenna thing out, and there's a little bit of wool soaked in lighter fuel. And you go to a nearby candle, light that, and then you can light your cigar. But if you haven't played in the match, you can't use the silver shrimp's lighter.
It seems like a lot of fun, and it definitely is one of the coolest things about it. I love the shrimp logo. In fact, I've now going to be carrying the Royal Lytham and St. Anne's golf bag. And so when I brought it back to America, the first thing I did is I'm having it tricked out. Over on the side pocket, they're going to put a whole shrimp on it, the same shrimp on the logo. And I'd like to see if I could throw out, forgive the American for throwing out an American-ish idea, but what do you think of this hashtag, Rock the Shrimp?
Rock the shrimp.
Yes, rock the shrimp, as in like I'm carrying the shrimp. I got it on my shirt. I'm rocking the shrimp. It's like you're showing off your colors. It's like you're proud of your team. You're showing your support. You're
Go
rocking
in for
the
slightly more understated exaltation here. If you get very excited here, a little smile hits the corner of your mouth. That's as
right. So
excited as you're allowed to get.
I guess the second idea I had. Shrimptastic is out then. All right, well, presuming normal transmission, what about this idea? How about a competition between all eight of the great links clubs? West Lancs, Wallasey, Birkdale, Lytham, Hoy Lake, Formby, Hillside. and Southport.
Yeah, there's some great courses.
All eight send a team of maybe five players, and you have a one-day tournament, or each group sends two guys, and you have a three-day tournament. But something organized between all eight of the great links courses that you could do every year. How much fun would that be?
Yeah, you could have the Northwest Challenge, and it could be moved around the eight courses in sequence.
Exactly. Okay, and a shrimp would be a terrific idea for a trophy, or a windmill. Isn't that the logo of St. Anne's? Is it a windmill, if I remember correctly?
Yes, St. Anne's Old Links has a windmill, I think, and Lytham Green Drive, another golf course, has a windmill as its logo. On the seafront at Lytham, well, it's bordering onto the estuary of the river. There is a windmill which was grinding corn until 1920, and it's still there as a tourist attraction. It's a very, very pretty feature.
Is that not one of the symbols of the town of St. Anne's?
Yeah, well, the town of Lytham.
I meant the not the shrimp. I meant the windmill. Isn't the windmill?
Yeah, the windmill is associated with Lytham.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah, because it's been there since about 1700, whereas St. Anne's didn't exist until 1874. It was just sandhills.
When might we see? I've heard rumors 2029 and 2031. When might we see the open return to Lytham?
I've no idea. They have a nice thing in the States. They announce the year of allocation. A friend was telling me at his course they've been allocated the US Open in 2051. They already know it.
It's getting a little ridiculous. I'd liked it when we had it 8 or 9 years in advance, but
And here they've
I
only
see why
announced
they're.
2027. They haven't announced 2028 yet.
Right, exactly.
So I don't know. It'd be lovely to see the world's top players taking on the course again and seeing how they enjoy themselves and seeing them struggle as the same way we do. There's only two
Well,
courses that haven't had a 63 ever, that the best rounds ever at the course have been 64 only. Nobody's beaten 64, and that's Carnoustie and Lytham.
that's right. That's correct. And so I look very much forward to when we get the wonderful news that Lytham will be hosting the Open again, and hopefully it'll come back soon and often.
It'll
Thank
be
you
nice if
so
we get
much
that.
for coming on the show. It was wonderful to walk down memory lane with you and see all of these fantastic historical mileposts.
Thanks very much. I've enjoyed it immensely. Good to talk to you.
I look very much forward to having you on the show again. One more time, everybody. Stephen Reed, author of The Royal Lytham and St. Anne's Golf Club and the Amateur Game, their unofficial historian and the club secretary from 1996. Thank you again, sir, and we will see you and your wonderful club soon.
Thank you very much. Look forward to it.